Hello and welcome to the introductory episode of Voices in Your Head. I'm Dave Slusher, your host, and my guest this week is author and columnist James Patrick Kelly. As a science fiction writer, he's been nominated for all of the highest awards in the science fiction field, winning the Hugo Award for his stories 10 to the 16th to 1 and Think Like a Dinosaur. As a teacher, he's frequently taught at the Clarion Writers Workshop, where he's inspired young writers such as Cory Doctorow. In the 1990s, his before-mentioned story, Think Like a Dinosaur, was adapted for a radio play by the sci-fi channel Seeing Ear Theater. He writes the internet column for Asimov Science Fiction Magazine, amongst his many responsibilities, and is experimenting with making his work available as downloadable MP3s of his readings. Thanks, and welcome to the show, Jim.
I'm glad to be here.
So, for those people who might not be familiar with your background and your work, tell us, let's take a whirlwind history through your kind of career. When did you start writing, and what kind of brought you into writing fiction?
I guess I was a weird little kid, like so many science fiction writers, a bookish kid in elementary school. Although later on in high school, I did jock out a little bit. I was a runner, and there's something about the solitude of running, I think, that fit into my personality in terms of just thinking as when you've got nothing else to do but logging those long miles. And I went to college at the University of Notre Dame, and I was an English major. My dad wanted me to be a math major, and I lasted in freshman advanced math class for about a semester, pulling down a high C, which was like actually at the top of the class there, but I just didn't see any future in it for me. So I was an English major, graduated in 3 years from the University of Notre Dame, and went to work in public relations, of all things, for an architectural engineering firm. And I should back up to say that I really always wanted to be a writer of some sort, probably since I was in the certainly in high school, and possibly when I was in eighth grade, I won an award from Cardinal Spellman. I went to a Catholic school. Matter of fact, I should say here, I went to Catholic school K through college. But in eighth grade, I won an award for writing some essay, which the topic of which eludes me, which earned me a Bible signed by Cardinal Spellman, who was the Cardinal of New York diocese at that time. And so even then, although I have since fallen away from the church, I was... it seemed like I had an interest in writing. So I wanted to be a writer, but then I thought I'd also like to be starting guard for the Celtics. I'd like to be an astronaut and the President of the United States when I retired. And I thought all of those, avocations were probably equally unlikely. But when I got out of Notre Dame and I was working in public relations, I started writing stuff and sending it off for the first time. And but the real turning point in my wannabe career was when I went to the Clarion Writers Workshop in 1974, and that was a revelation. Clarion, for those of you who may not know, is, as some people have called it, the equivalent of science fiction boot camp. 6 weeks in the summer, each week a different writer comes in and expounds and workshops, critiques, with the group of 16 to 19 wannabes, of which I was one in 1974. And shortly after I graduated, if that's what you want to call it, from Clarion, I sold my first story in 1975. And but my career at this point did not exactly rocket to the skies. I was sort of, I don't want to say blocked because I was writing, but I was very frustrated. I was writing but not selling at this point. And so in 1976, I asked if I could come back to Clarion, which was sort of an odd thing to do. I was the last person to go to Clarion twice. And they let me back in, and I wrote some more stories. And I think one of the things I was trying to do at that point was send a message to my family, to my boss, and not least of which to myself, that I was really going to do this. Because the second time I went to Clarion, I really just sort of killed my career in public relations. They sort of said, this guy isn't dependable. His heart is elsewhere. And so, and in 1978, I sold my second story, which is, as you can see, that's a bit of a lag between the two stories. And I had the ecstatic moment, which actually was another turning point for me. In 1979, Terry Carr, the late great anthologist, short story writer, and novelist, picked my second published story for the year's best science fiction. And so at that point, I sort of had the green light, the validation that I thought I needed. And I eased out of my public relations job and finally was retired at the ripe old age of 26 and haven't had a real job since.
So you sort of subconsciously committed career suicide on your path to being a writer.
That's sort of the only way I could get myself to do it. It's really hard, and I have nothing but respect and admiration for people who hold down a real job and try to write at night. It's heavy lifting of the most excruciatingly psychological sort, because you got to find time for your writing, you got to find time, psychic space for your job, and assuming as which I hope is not too big an assumption, you have some sort of emotional relationship. Well, when does your partner get her time or his time, and how about your kids? And basically those folks sometimes have to survive on 5 hours of sleep a night, which was beyond my capabilities.
So when you started writing, what attracted you to the science fiction genre specifically?
Well, it's interesting because when I went to college and was an English major in the late 60s, early 70s, science fiction was looked down upon. And I had a little bit of that I had to erase from my artistic temperament. And so when I first started writing, I was writing everything, although I certainly wasn't proud, because I tried to write mysteries, I wrote mainstream, I sent stuff to New Yorker, I sent stuff to Playboy. I even tried to write Confession magazine stories. I actually got some very charming rejection slips from the Confession thing. This is almost there. But as I wrote, the things I felt most comfortable and the things that engaged me the most were the fantastic. And I have to say, my early stuff was more of the... certainly more literary and more contemporary Twilight Zone-ish kind of stuff, rather than the cyberpunkish or a hard SF or extrapolative science fiction I dabbled with later on in my career.
So you mentioned the CP word, so
I
wanted one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because that was around the time that I was really getting interested in reading, was about the time that the kind of cyberpunk movement, and it's almost hard to think back to when that was a movement. It's now, now it's part of the landscape, right? It's,
yeah.
It's ambient. It's what you breathe. But remembering that as a separate thing, and not just a separate thing, but a like new thing, and people are, writing about it and talking about this subgenre.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I actually have recently been talking about the kind of Bruce Sterling and his sort of faux feud that he created with the humanists as a kind of, I don't know Bruce's motivation, but kind of like as a PR almost.
Right.
So you were kind of, like what you were just saying, you were kind of on both sides of the fence in this particular, situation.
I was. Well, the story here, the backstory of this is that if we skip back to my biography, in 1974, I went to Clarion. I was 22, and there was a precocious young Texan by the name of Bruce Sterling, who was 19, who went to Clarion at the same time as I did. Now, Bruce and I were, everyone at Clarion bonds and are good friends. And Bruce and I weren't the best of friends, although I certainly was in great admiration for his work. And after we sort of went our separate ways for several years, I fell in with the humanist crowd, and my best friends in science fiction are Connie Willis and John Kessel, who Bruce had along with Stan Robinson, who was another good friend. Bruce had taken aim at these folks as the polar opposite of our generation, the folks that he didn't want to be, and he wanted other people to read critically, let's say that. Let's put a charitable spin on it. My take on what Bruce was doing was, yes, it was a PR thing for his kind of writing, but it was also a very polemical in the best sense of the word, in that he wanted to get a dialogue going. He wanted people to talk about what the future of science fiction ought to be, and it certainly got my attention. And I should say that there is a ream of correspondence that he and John Kessel had that I've seen. Bruce and I also at this point were corresponding, but not at the length or at the high level that John and Bruce were corresponding. And you can see in this correspondence where Bruce is moving his position as well as John is moving his position. And eventually, Bruce and John collaborated, which was like matter and antimatter, clashing here. But in fact, it did not annihilate the universe. It made a quite acceptable story that was at once cyberpunk and humanist. And so, but the values here were, the humanists were interested in fiction as, okay, you know, this is sort of the cliche, but let's do it. You know, the humanists were interested in the fiction, and the cyberpunks were interested in the science. And so it was the sort of the two-culture thing. Of course, the science that the cyberpunks were advocating for wasn't the, you know, lab coat, analog, pocket protector, slide rule kind of science and engineering. It was the stuff that was happening on the street, the way that technology had insinuated itself and was into our everyday lives and was changing the way we lived and thought and just about everything about the world. And so cyberpunk was deeply interested in the impact of computers and biotech and all the technologies that were really looming at the time, at the 80s, when this so-called controversy raged. And so, you know, ultimately, I think Bruce wrote some wonderful humanist stories. Would have been, if there had been, Bruce put out a definitive anthology called Mirror Shades in, I want to say 1985. And he had gone to David Hartwell and said to David, there's this new thing happening, cyberpunk. I got four or five of my friends who want to put out an anthology. And David said to him, and I actually have asked David about this, and he confirms. He said, well, Bruce, that's all well and good, but four or five doesn't make a movement. You need 12. And so
he can quantify what a movement is.
Yeah, right, exactly. So he said, well, he cast around, well, where can I find these other? And I had written some sort of satirical, from a humanist point of view, cyberpunk-ish stories. And Bruce just loved it and said, yeah, okay, you're in. Here's your ticket. Here's your Mirror Shades. Join the club. And so in that way, I was inaugurated into the I was a fringe, shall we say, a fringe cyberpunk. And in retrospect, you know, these divisions are so blurred at this point that it's hard to say, you know, exactly what cyberpunk was. At the time, I had wrote a review saying, you know, it could easily happen that you could put a very credible sequel to Mirror Shades together using nothing but humanist work, and I still, you know, I still am of that opinion.
Mm-hmm. Well, to me, the interesting thing about the dichotomy is, you know, kind of one of the shifts in what we think of as, you know, golden age science fiction to kind of cyberpunk is that cyberpunk, you know, has the trappings of technology. I mean, technology, you know, is an essential portion of this fiction, but ultimately it's all about the effect of that technology on people. It's not about the tech in isolation.
Right. Exactly.
So so in a lot of ways, cyberpunk is more about people than anything else.
Well, yes and no. Definitely it's keenly interested in the impact of technology on society. Whether all the individuals in the early cyberpunk were particularly wonderful characters or believable characters. I mean, you'll recall that the early cyberpunks did not have any women in it, in this movement. As a matter of fact, you know, he had to cast around, well, okay, so Pat Cadigan, she sort of fit the bill. So she was one of the ones who was dragooned into Mirror Shades along with me and Paul DiFilippo and some other folks, Mark Laidlaw, sort of fringe people in terms of the movement, the philosophy of the movement. But, you know, there's some question as to whether the early cyberpunk stuff is, you know, it's certainly not Henry James character studies, that's for sure. And so the critique that some of the more mainstream critics leveled at them was, yeah, sure, this is glitzy, and it's, you know, the prose shines and glints, and but where are the people? We see how this technology has changed the world, but how has it changed individuals? And you know, I think to some extent that's an unfair generalization, but I think that for some of the works, you know, they're just not as deep as the cyberpunks later went on to do. I mean, I think some of the stuff that I just finished reading, Pattern Recognition, which is interesting because it's William Gibson's latest book, which isn't set in the future, but I think it's a much better character study than Neuromancer.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, one of the kind of things that people, I guess, one of the kind of misconceptions that people, you know, a layperson might have about a writer of science fiction is that part of what you're about is kind of trying to, you know, plant a flag in the ground as a predictor of things, right?
Right.
So if you're writing, you know, this fiction, you know, in 1984 that's got, you know, a worldwide information net,
right?
That somehow you have scored a coup. It's like, ooh, I said there was a worldwide information net.
Yeah.
And the quote that I always love about this is, I believe it's Ray Bradbury who said that, "I'm not trying to predict the future, I'm trying to prevent the future."
Yeah, sure. That's a long and honored tradition in science fiction. The "if this goes on" story, which is basically the cautionary tale. If this goes on, if we keep on polluting the environment, if we keep on building nukes, if we keep on dehumanizing people, then we arrive at some awful end society. And the science fiction writer's job is to show just how awful that society would be if we don't change the course of civilization. But this whole idea of predicting the future is—it's what, as you say, the lay audience might, you know, expect of us. But it's sort of the Arthur C. Clarke conundrum, which is, you know, okay, why are we? One of the reasons why we know Arthur C. Clarke, why some people know Arthur C. Clarke, was, well, he predicted communication satellites. He said, okay, well, in a very otherwise uninteresting story, that he published in the, well, I don't know, 50s or 60s, I'm not sure. No, he predicts that there'll be birds up there that we bounce signals off of, and we'll have a worldwide communications network. Wow, cool! Wow, Arthur C. Clarke predicted the future. But, you know, Arthur C. Clarke has a giant body of work, and most of his predictions did not come true. Matter of fact, this is one of the interesting things. Now you got me off on one of my hobby horses. This is one of the interesting things about science fiction that I've been thinking about a lot, and that is, what is the nature of science fiction that has passed its sell-by date? In other words, okay, so you mentioned 1984. What is 1984? When 1984 was written in 1951, whenever it was, it was science fiction. I mean, In the terms that we most commonly understand, it was a story which talked about a future which might potentially come true. Not that it was likely, but it was potentially the future. And I think this is the predictive tradition in science fiction. You don't necessarily say this is the future, but the game that you're playing is that the future you're writing about could happen. And so there's the reader, as he reads, in his own mind, if the author doesn't lay out a map, maps the way today becomes that tomorrow. Well, you know, it ain't necessarily so. That's not one of the things that science fiction does.
So when you're writing, to what extent are you kind of, I don't know, like building an incubator for new ideas? Or I would see that as one of the values of this, is the ability for people to begin to think about issues and think about ideas before they're actually a problem in our day-to-day life. You know, it's like a dry dock. It's like a lab that you can think about, you know, the problems of the future.
Well, so this is, yeah, okay, this comes back to the cautionary tale thing, the problems of the future. Okay, yeah, and like I said, I think that's a long and honored tradition. For myself, and this is something I think I actually got from from Bruce more than Bill, Bruce Sterling more than Bill Gibson, because I've actually been a closer student of Bruce's work than of Bill's. And that is that the idea, not just so much that we need to be afraid or be warned off the future, but I look at science fiction as a kind of inoculant against future shock. That is to say, if you write about futures that are likely to happen, and some form of that future actually comes to pass, then what you're doing when you're reading about it is getting yourself ready to live in that future. Now, one of the things that's interesting about that is that the future is going to make some people very uncomfortable. And many of the stories that I've written are stories that ask the reader to imagine a future in which human values that we think possibly are etched in the fabric of the universe are proved not to be particularly, you know, immutable at all. In fact, that they've been subverted in this future and people treat it as a commonplace. And so, you know, for instance, I guess my most famous story is Think Like a Dinosaur. And in Think Like a Dinosaur, you know, there's an absolute prohibition, thou shalt not kill. And in Think Like a Dinosaur, there is a plot that posits a future in which killing is not only rational, it's the only thing to do. And so, how do we live in that future? And what does that mean for what we thought humanity was, what human nature was? And to me, this is one of the more profound jobs of work that science fiction has to do. Not so much to warn us off as to get us ready.
Mm-hmm. Well, since you mentioned Think Like a Dinosaur, let's talk a little about that. I had noticed in your introduction to that story, I think for the fiction-wise version, mm-hmm. you'd refer to it not only as your most famous work, but like something to the effect of, if that was, you know, if it was chiseled into your gravestone that I wrote this story, I can, you know, I can deal with that. There are worse things to be known for. Yeah. And in fact, you know, Rick Wilbur, the science fiction author and professor, I've seen him refer to that as the most perfect science fiction short story.
Oh, Rick, I owe him another $20.
Just in terms of, you know, thematic purity, kind of, you know, in focus, you know, in concision of what it's trying to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, yeah, I mean, that's a very, I mean, I'm honored that people think that, but, you know, it's like, I've had a fairly long career, and I've been fortunate to have a couple of stories that were my most famous story before Think Like a Dinosaur, and I've won a Hugo Award subsequent to that, and I've written some stories that people talk about. But it's clear that, you know, if I meet any random sampling of science fiction fans, you know, that's the touchstone story that, oh, you're the guy who wrote that. You know, some of my other stories, like 10 to the 16th to 1, which won a Hugo, or Undone, which was nominated for a ton of stuff, and Itsy Bitsy Spider, or some of these stories, Bernardo's House, just a recent Hugo nominee. Some of these stories, you know, people, oh yeah, you wrote that? But like, Think Like a Dinosaur is the one that folks know. And, you know, and I'm very pleased that people think of that as a, you know, a paradigm of science fiction. But, you know, it's certainly in the tradition, as some people may know who are familiar with the story, it's a story that's in dialogue with another very famous story called The Cold Equations. But it's at once, when I set out to write that story, what I really was intending at the time was to write a short shocker, which is sort of, if you know the very briefly, the plot of The Cold Equations is, which is a which in fact other very respected folks like I think Greg Benford held up as a model of what science fiction should be. In Cold Equations, a young girl sails away on a spaceship that is carrying medical supplies to a sick colony, and she pops out and it's just her and the pilot. The pilot is horrified to find her there because they have laid in just enough fuel to get the colony. And so the way the physics of space rocket science work in this world, she's got to leave the spaceship, but how can she leave? They're in space. The ultimate, you know, ending of that story is that she walks bravely out of the airlock, and the medical supplies get delivered. And my idea when I started writing thick-legged dinosaur was that the space pilot would have to sew her, pitch her bodily out, because she wasn't, no one's going to walk out the airlock. They're going to go kicking and screaming. But as I spun a different scenario, other stuff intervened, and the story grew and grew and grew and became much more philosophical. And there still is a delicious, for me anyway, scene in which she gets pushed out the airlock. But that's not, although that might be the emotional climax of the story, it's not the philosophical climax.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of that story, which is, you know, worth mentioning, is it goes back to my resume. So I went to Clarion twice. I am a major league workshop aficionado. Almost all my work has been workshopped. And I brought Think Like a Dinosaur to my workshop, my local workshop here. I live in New Hampshire, but I workshop in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I recall with great fondness and the workshop where I put that story through the workshop, because they argued about the story while they were critiquing it. And after the critique was done, we took a break, and people wanted to get coffee and donuts. They were still arguing about it 20 minutes later when it was time to start the next story. And I thought, you know, their critiques were sharp and critical. They thought this and that, and had I thought about this. But to me, this whole dialogue that happened during the workshop sort of recapitulated the subsequent history of that story, and that is, this story gets under people's skin. And, you know, I touched lightning there. I don't know if I've ever touched it quite so, or grabbed it quite so tightly as I did that time. But I could tell at the workshop that this was a story that was going to, you know, cast some sparks.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I can see, too, you know, kind of, you know, as you do a sort of statistical analysis of your work, you know, I'm sure that you're, like, when you're writing each story, you're fairly close, and you don't think, wow, this is one of my major themes. I'm going to, here is theme C that I frequently touch upon. So let's get it into this one.
Yeah, right.
But I do notice from, like, looking over your body of work that you've written, you know, over 30 years, that one of the questions that seems to drive most, if not almost all of your fiction, is the kind of edge case of what makes a person.
Right.
How far can I take somebody out and they are still have essentially what makes them them? And that's, you know, one of the primary themes of Think Like a Dinosaur.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, yeah, the question of identity and what can you change, what is essential. In Think Like a Dinosaur, the situation is unlike the Cold Equations in that instead of taking a faster-than-light spaceship or a generation spaceship between stars, what happens is you step into basically what's a galactic fax machine, and they take a picture of you, and they send your facsimile to the other place. And this creates a conundrum, because at the moment when they send the facsimile, there are two yous. And the philosophical and, you know, rubber technology of this story demands that you accept that the facsimile and the original are exactly the same. If you don't accept that, then the story sort of has a different meaning altogether. But my intent was that you accept that for that brief moment, the facts, the duplicate and the original are the very same. Now, as soon as the duplicate steps out of the transmitter, she, in this case, diverges from the original because she's in a different place, she's having different experiences, and the original is back on Earth having different experiences. But the logic of the world building that I did in that story was that the original must go because there can only be one you. And so usually the killing of the original is sort of antiseptic and nobody needs to get their hands dirty. But in this case, the person who is sending the astronaut, the fax person, must get his hands dirty. He must actually do the deed himself and kill the original because of a malfunction.
But the notion that now you've got two copies of this person.
Right.
And are both copies of that person?
Yeah, that both copies of that person, as I said, at the moment of transmission. But subsequently, and the story makes this point, the copy goes off and has other experiences, and so that changes who she is. And if the original was allowed to live, that original would go back to Earth or wherever she lived and have her life. And so there'd be the same person living two different lives, and that's clearly two different people, even though that they started out as the same person.
So now we're running out of time, and I get so much I wanted to cover with you.
Sure.
And so I want to talk a little about your work as an internet columnist, and kind of you've got some experimentations into the internet world, which are make you a little unique amongst your colleagues. So let's talk a little about this internet column that you write for Asimov's science fiction magazine. How did you first get involved in that?
It was actually on the internet that I got the gig, which is apropos, I suppose. Gardner Dozois, who was then editor of Asimov, was having a chat on the Asimov website. Actually, I think it was probably on sci-fi.com. And I was chatting with him, and I forget even who was the guest. It was not me, but I had dropped in, and was at the end of the day, we were, you know, emailing or chatting back and forth, and I suggested that there might be a internet column. And my idea for the internet columnist, my suggestion was that it would be Bruce Sterling. Well, it turns out that Sheila Williams, who is now the editor of Asimov, and Gardner had already talked about that, and Sheila had mentioned that it would be a cool thing to have an internet column. And so the next day, I got an email from Sheila saying, we're very, you know, jazzed about your idea about an internet column. Would you like to write it? And I was a little bit taken aback and thought about it for, 8 or 9 seconds, and wrote back and said, yeah, I'd love to do it. And I wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to do, and I also was certain that it wouldn't go more than 10 installments or so. I mean, after you've, you know, talked about, you know, all the science fiction sites on the internet that might be, all the sites on the internet that might be of interest to science fiction fans, I thought, well, that's like, you know, 5 or 10 installments, and then I'll run out of things to say. But, you know, I'm coming up on my 6th year here, and I have not yet run out of things to say. I have to say that my... you mentioned in the introduction, the first internet columnist for Science Fiction Magazine was Cory Doctorow, and I had been looking at his column for some time. He was writing a column in Science Fiction Age, which ended not because his column wasn't the very best, but because Science Fiction Age folded. And so I modeled myself on his, which was very much a proto-blog kind of URL-driven column, but ultimately, I was more interested, it turns out, as a surprise to even myself, in pontificating. And so, I you know, certainly there are plenty of URLs in my column, but lots of it is about cogitating about the future of copyright, or the future of e-books, or the future of the Hugo Awards, or, you know, what robots might look like, you know, in fact and fiction. And so it was much more about... pontificate is too formal and rant is too histrionic, but someplace in between pontification and ranting is what I think I'm doing.
Does this now, you know, part of the beat that you're working there is you're kind of you know, you've got unlike your fiction where you can go comfortably far out, right. you get to kind of be looking at the near future,
right? Exactly,
and to be kind of a cool hunter,
right.
Is that kind of a fairly pressure-filled gig? I mean, it seems like you've got, and particularly because you have a long lead time.
I do.
Have like 6 or 8 months that you have to write these before they see print.
Oh, yeah. And what's often sort of the headache of this column is that, so by the time I get the galleys, Sheila Williams will say, okay, now here are the galleys, just check them over. And so I type in all the URLs again, and I have to say, in every column, maybe one or two of the URLs has either, you know, gone dead or changed or something. So the internet is a squiggly thing. You can't like tack it down to any one, you know, minute. And I have to say, I just recently, for the first time, wrote a column about blogs. And it, you know, what is it that I do but, you know, sort of a dead tree retro blog? and there's so many other bloggers out there now that people could. People can, you know, find wonderful URLs and great rants and cutting edge, you know, extrapolations. I was thinking, well, if I write this column, that may be my resignation. But nonetheless, I did commit a column about the top 40 science fiction blogs that I follow.
And I imagine one of them was William Gibson, who probably stopped doing it before it actually saw print.
Well, yeah, you know, it's interesting that, you know, the evolution of the blog. When I started writing the column in 1998, the word blog itself hadn't yet been invented. It was only in, I believe, 1997 that somebody decided to call this thing on the web a web blog. And it was the year after I started that the neologism blog was coined. And so, to some extent, you know, although Cory Doctorow was there way before I was in terms of the print thing, you know, this whole notion, which fills a necessary niche in the internet for sure, you know, it's the mediated guide to the internet. You could waste a long time typing robot into Google and following all the links. And so what helps with these blogs, and I hope with my column, is that, you know, okay, I did this thing that you might have done yourself and wasted a lot of time, and I wasted my time for you to get you the ones that are more interesting than the fan sites and the dead links and all the other stuff, the detritus that lives on the internet.
So you were one of the first people to sign on with FictionWise for legitimate to distribute legitimate versions of ebooks of your work.
Mm-hmm.
So what was your kind of motivation to join that experiment?
Well, I'd had a website for some time before even I started doing the column, and one of the features of my website has always been to give away stories for free. Now, I didn't put my entire backlog of fiction up on the web, but, you know, on any given day, there are between 8 and 10 stories that anyone can download, and I put no restrictions on it. I haven't actually published them in PDF or Microsoft Reader form, but they're there in HTML for anyone to, you know, read off the screen or you know, fool around with as they see fit. So, for me, one of the saddest things about my career as a science fiction writer is, and I think this is true for any writer, is that I'm standing here in my office, I'm looking at my file drawer, and there are a bunch of stories I am really proud of that live only in this file drawer and in dusty back copies of Asimov that probably nobody pulls out. What good are they doing anyone, you know, in a drawer? What good are they doing anyone in an attic? What good are they doing anyone in a landfill? And so my idea was, get these stories out where people can read them, and the theory being that if they liked them, they'd look for the new stuff. And so, and FictionWise was actually paying, you know, some pretty decent rates. It was an experiment, and as far as I can see, it's a wildly successful experiment. I've been very happy with it.
I know that I'm not that up on, you know, what people have been saying recently, but I know at that time there was a lot of kind of pushback from a lot of people, a lot of your colleagues, that were basically worried that what this does is gives an entree for people to just ad infinitum, basically rip you off and just trade this around and never, you know, conceivably it would be possible to sell one copy and then never sell another one.
Right. Well, that's not that's not how it's played out. You know, this is this objection, I think, has been amply answered by two different and to some extent philosophically, politically disparate sources, one of which is Bain Books, which gives away, you know, huge, I mean, they give away novels. You can go to the Bain site and download some of their product. And Cory Doctorow, who, you know, made his first three books, I believe, available for download. And the proof is in the pudding. The sales do well. And sales for stories that are for these novels that are published on the web do very well, in some cases possibly better than they might have done if there were no other ancillary ebook version that make people say, hey, they give these things a buzz. Now, if this becomes common practice, whether the posting an ebook on the web before or simultaneously with the print version will work the same way, because to some extent this is a early adopter thing. Well, this is cool. I'm cool. I'm reading this book on the web, and you know, just to support Cory, I'm going to buy the book too. Or I like the book so much, I'm going to give it to my Aunt Ethel because, you know, this way, Cory will get some more dough. I'm not really sure that that's how it's going to work in the future, but right now it's working all to the good for the authors. So, you know, I'm very happy to publish as much as I can, you know, and to take it even another level, I've gone into audio publishing, as you may know, So not only have I published stories that you can download in HTML, but I've been fooling around with MP3s. And so there is right now 10 stories of mine that you can download off my website in MP3 format. And there's basically, they're open to anyone who wants to download them. You know, download them yourself, send them to your pal in Prussia or your aunt in, you know, in Dubuque, whatever. I have put a little tip jar there on my website. So if you like what you read, if you would send me some dough, the idea here is that every time I get enough to go back into the studio, it costs about $200 to go into the studio for 3 hours and record some new stories. Every time I get $200, I go back to the studio. And I've been once, and I have to say that I'm well on my way to going again probably before the end of the year.
Do people, when people tip, do they suggest what they want the next one to be?
No, you know, it's a PayPal thing. And I have to sympathize with people who are a little leery of PayPal, but it's worked for me so far. There's no real way for folks to say when they give me the dough, and usually, you know, the money that people give is usually $2, $3, $5. And they just, the PayPal notifies me that I've gotten this money, and what I have done is send them emails saying thank you. A couple of them have written back, but so far nobody has actually requested anything, and I haven't actually decided what, or I mean, I have 70 stories, and so I've got 10 up now. So there's a lot of, I can't decide whether to go into my backlog or stay current, but I try to do a little bit of both in each iteration.
There's like, as we speak, like right now, there's sort of a factional schism in certain portions of the blogging community about some people are beginning to do this via audio. And, you know, one of the big criticisms is that that audio as a kind of entertainment and information transmission mechanism is kind of rigid. And you, if you have a 1 hour story, it takes 1 hour to listen to it.
Right.
And, you know, it's just kind of locked in and it limits the ways that you can consume it. But so from your perspective, when you do this, what kind of things does putting out the audio of the reading bring to the table that you couldn't have there any other way?
Well, to me, and I have to say that I am a big, can I say the word audible.com on
sure.
your show? I am a total... I'm a total spoken word freak. I used to live in a mid-sized city here in New Hampshire, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and the library had a just stunningly wonderful audiobook collection on tape. And so I just fell into that whole hog. And then I moved to a smaller town, and I love our little library here in Nottingham, New Hampshire, but it's a little town. It's a town of 3,000, and you can imagine how big the library is. Their audiobook, you know, collection I went through in a couple months. And so I subscribe to audible.com and I listen to books. Almost all my pleasure reading as opposed to my reading for work comes from audible.com. And I'm here to say that I think there's a qualitative difference in spoken word and written word, obviously, that not everyone is trained to hear, and it takes a while, I think, to be able to absorb an audiobook. You have to train your ear and your mind to get this information and to be able to parse through it. And, you know, since it might take 5 or 10 or 20 sessions to listen to a novel, you know, you have to be able to remember, obviously you do this in a book as well, where you were when you left off. But for me, the whole thing is the performance. And you know, if you're looking for an audiobook for information only, then fine for you. But for me, it's the way it's read. It's especially with fiction. Obviously, with fiction, you know, when you hear a skillful audio narrator do the voices, and they don't have to do, you know, old Walter Brennan old folks and, you know, squeaky voice young folks and Irish brogue and Scottish lilt and all that stuff. But it's just the way the lines are spoken that really brings the work to life, and I think this is once again a skill that we need to reacquire in order to fully appreciate the artistry of performance. And so, for me, you know, I'm no actor, but I'm a ham anyway, and I just love to read my own stuff.
Well, I wonder if some of it too is cultural in that, you know, for maybe the past 40 years or so, 30 years, we don't have a big tradition of radio plays.
Right.
Where there's kind of a rebirth in some ways, like the Seeing Ear Theater that adapted Think Like a Dinosaur was kind of an experiment in that. And I listened to a number of those productions and thought that they were kind of fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, well, this is, to me, I shouldn't say it's a disappointment, but I will say it's a gap in my artistic life. I really loved the Seeing Ear Theater things, and I was very tight with the folks who were making them. I actually wrote 5 plays for Seeing Ear Theater, and several of them were my own, and a couple of them were, well, all 4 of them were my own, and one of them was a Tales from the Crypt adaptation. But and several of them were original. I just thought it was a great format. I loved the collaborative thing. I've actually written some theatrical plays as well. And so I love the idea of collaborating with actors. And I have to say that my own reading has been informed by the way I read my stories has been informed by my collaboration with directors and actors. I mean, I really can see how they work through material. And so, yeah, I was very sad to see them fold. And there's some wonderful stuff still there for free. I mean, you could spend the better part of a month listening to all the stuff on Seeing Ear Theater, and almost all of it is worthwhile.
Now, with your releasing of the MP3s of your readings, you've got those out as a Creative Commons license.
Right.
Now, to what extent does the existence of the Creative Commons licensing scheme kind of enable that? In that, now you have a kind of standardized way. You don't have to start from scratch and say and inform everybody and say, here's my MP3s, but you know, here's what I think is acceptable and here's what I think is non-acceptable. You know, you can say Creative Commons, you know, share alike, non-commercial,
right,
attribution, go.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I have to say, though, that before there was a Creative Commons, there was a warning, a proviso on my website, say, look, I'm Jim Kelly, I'm releasing this to the web, do with it as you wish, except please don't publish it as your own, please don't plagiarize it, and please don't sell it to other people. And if you find anyone else who's selling this stuff to you, and I'm not participating in it, I wish you'd let me know, because you're being ripped off, and so am I. Because I intended that stuff all to be free. So if someone's selling it, then that's against my intention. Now, so this is sort of a trusting in human nature notice at the top of my website. Well, Creative Commons, I don't think is any. I mean, there's law behind it. I think that if there were violations of the Creative Commons license, I'd have a better chance of litigating. But you know, I really don't see the web as being that malign. You know, I think most of the people come to my site anyway are doing exactly what I want them to do, which is to say they're reading my stuff, they're enjoying it, they're probably thinking about who I am, and maybe they're looking for me in some other incarnation, some other print or digital incarnation, and that's what I'm doing it. You know, which isn't to say that, you know, so some guy in Estonia is pirating my stuff. You know, am I going to wring $37 out of Estonia in order to keep to be happy? No, I want people in Estonia to read my stuff. I want people in Croatia to read my stuff. I want people in Brazil to read my stuff. And so, you know, I'd like to be paid, but on the other hand, I have to say this, and that most of my stuff that is available on the web is short stories. And as people well know, there's not exactly the golden path to wealth in writing short stories, and so to some extent, the allowing my short story rights to go sort of relatively unprotected is not making a big bet against, you know, fraud.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, that kind of brings us around pretty cleanly to the back to where we started. What kind of things are in the works for you in the near future, Jim?
Well, I just recently finished. I have a weird sort of, it's a half superstition, half tradition thing going with my favorite science fiction magazine, Asimov Science Fiction, where I've been in the June issue for 20 years as of this year, 2004, and I just recently, as a matter of fact, it's sitting on my computer ready to be submitted probably later today, even as we speak, to Asimov for the 21st June story. I'm working on a novella, which will be a chapbook from Tachyon Press, tentatively called Burn, which will come out next fall. And I told some of my friends this, and they nodded and said, yeah, sure, Jim. But It's been almost 10 years. It's been 10 years since I published my last novel, and I have 30,000 words of a novel I'm quite fond of. I just have not been motivated to work on it. But my New Year's resolution, being made here in the month of October, is that in 2005, back to the novel, and take another tilt at that windmill. So I'm hoping maybe by 2006 you'll see another Jim Kelly novel.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I'm a big fan, and I want to thank you for kind of inaugurating our new show here, and for sharing in with me, smashing the champagne across the prow.
Woo-hoo! It's been an honor, and I've had a great time.
All right, thanks, Jim.
Right.
You've been listening to Voices in Your Head, hosted by Dave Slusher. My name is Doug Kay, and I hope you'll join me next time for another edition of Voices in Your Head on IT Conversations.